Mike Lofgren came to Washington in the early 1980s at the dawn of the Reagan era for what he imagined would be a short stint on Capitol Hill. He never imagined he'd end up staying 28 years. He's witnessed quite a few low points in his decades as a staffer on the Congressional and Senate Budget Committees, but none quite so pitiful, he says, as those we owe to the zany legislators we appear to have elected in 2008. His new book is The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Mike Lofgren spent 28 years on the Hill. He was a senior analyst for the last 16 years in the House and Senate Budget Committees, giving him a ringside seat on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, as well as funding of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We welcome Mike Lofgren to the roundtable this morning.
Pleasure to be here.
Talking about you quitting in frustration, at what point did you know it was time to go?
I think you had said 2008. It was actually in 2011 because I saw early on in that year that the new class of freshman Republicans were going to use the debt ceiling debate as a way to sort of hold the country hostage to get what they want. Because, you know, since World War II, I think we had had, before that, 87 times when the debt ceiling was increased, which, by the way, doesn't mean they're spending more money. They're just acknowledging past bills are being paid. And even Ronald Reagan in the 1980s pleaded with Congress, please pass a clean debt limit vote. Don't tack extraneous things on. Don't turn this into a political circus. But this time I saw was a little bit different. And as a result, Standard & Poor's downgraded America's credit rating.
You retired in 2011, as you mentioned, but it was that freshman class of 2008 where things had changed and you saw this difference. What I find fascinating, though, is that this was a process that I guess when you arrived in Washington, was there ever a golden age, in your opinion, from the time that you served, or was it all sort of broken and just got worse?
There's no such thing as golden ages in history or in politics, but I think on a relative basis, things were better. You had politicians like Howard Baker or Bob Dole. They had their own strong views, but at the end of the day, they knew they had to govern a country, and that meant they had to eventually cut deals, make compromises, and get bills passed. Now, progressively, that kind of faded away. And particularly after Barack Obama's election, it became so bitterly polarized that now we're just into gridlock, filibuster, which back in the 60s and 70s, you might have had single digits of filibusters in a congressional session. Now it's hundreds.
You say that even routine bills in Congress are almost impossible to pass. And how did this come about? You do look at Newt Gingrich's time as Speaker of the House and say that that's when part of the problem started.
Indeed. He was bent on almost bringing down the institution when he was on the outside by attacking leaders of the opposite party, by claiming it was corrupt, and so forth. And this was his way of dividing and conquering. And, you know, at the time I thought he's kind of like Robespierre in the French Revolution. He's very good at bringing down a governmental order. He's not good at setting one up.
When you look at your party, you ran as a Republican, a member of the Republican Party.
I didn't run. I was a staffer, but I was identified as a Republican.
You were identified as a Republican. At what point did you look and say, okay, I am that what I consider a Republican to be is not what is really out there, and what a Democrat is considered to be is not really what they are?
I think it was a progressive process. I was quite upset, at least in the foreign policy aspect of that, with the invasion of Iraq. I don't think that as a result of 9/11, one should invade the wrong country. And as a result, we incurred about, when you count the debt service costs, about $1 trillion in costs to invade and occupy Iraq. And we really didn't get anything out of it, except kind of a black eye. And that made me think, hey, their foreign policy is kind of going off the rails. And then when President Obama was elected, sure, I disagree with him on any number of issues. I think the health care bill gave kind of a payday to the big pharmaceutical companies. It gave certainly subsidies to insurance companies. It didn't do anything to bend the cost curve down. But to complain about it on the basis of death panels and all this other stuff was just silly. And they were reflexively opposing the elected president at a time of economic crisis in early 2009. We still hadn't gotten out of the Iraq war. We had a hot war in Afghanistan. And I'm thinking, this country has to pull together. We should not be doing, as Mitch McConnell said already in early 2009, just after the president was elected, that McConnell's goal was not getting people back to work or making sure the banking system is solvent or any of those other things that would help Americans. No, it's, I want to make sure Obama is a one-term president.
You write early on in the book, in the introduction, that you were compelled to write the book because, quote, I became alarmed by the trends I was seeing, in particular my own party, the Republican Party, began to scare me. Give us a sense of how that party, the Republican Party, started to scare you, and were you scared by the Democrats as well?
Oh, you know, there's any number of Democrats who say, you know, fairly lurid things. I mean, there was the former member Alan Grayson and Pete Stark, but they're not in the same concentration as what we've had recently with the Republican Party. You know, all these people talking about Obama's birth certificate, Muslim subversion of the government, death panels, all this other stuff. I think last week we had a Republican House member from Pennsylvania saying that simply the requirement that insurance plans cover contraception is another Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Now, come on. And that's the kind of thing that scares me. And these people, when they say outrageous things, like Alan West of Florida saying there's 83 or whatever the number he quoted, some high number of members of the Democratic caucus who are communists, that doesn't get him reproaches. That gets him kind of a fundraising bonanza. It seems that all the incentives these days are very perverse.
You write in the book about Mitt Romney, and how much of what you just described of the Republican Party do you think he represents?
You better ask him on, you know, which day he represents which part of the Republican Party. I mean, he's gone from being a Massachusetts moderate to a severe conservative, just depending on the way the wind blows. In other words, I'm not saying he's crazy or a lunatic or a fanatic by any means. He is by no means any of those things. However, he doesn't really seem to have any fixed principles in that regard.
What do you think attracted him to Republican leadership and to Republican voters, given that they had other choices?
I think the choices they had were so transparently flawed that he sort of became the default candidate. I mean, people like Herman Cain just spontaneously imploded. Movement Republicans see that Newt Gingrich is a very flawed candidate, and even Rick Santorum was just too far out for them. So Mitt Romney became kind of the default candidate, and now he's sort of catching up to the base by playing to their concerns, whether he honestly believes that or not.
And where does that leave voters choosing a president come November?
People will have to look hard at the issues of what are the economics, are the promises even credible? I mean, I am tired of hearing the media dissect, you know, the political and cultural implications of Chick-fil-A when Romney has laid out a budget plan that has, you know, very profound impacts. It would cut $6 trillion in taxes, and that means $6 trillion more to the deficit. He says it would be revenue neutral if we just get rid of deductions and tax loopholes. But if the Congress and certainly the Republicans were unwilling even to get rid of an egregious loophole like the corporate jet deductibility, are they going to get rid of mortgage interest deduction? Are they going to get rid of the health care exclusion? And in fact, that's something most middle class Americans depend on, and they would protest vehemently. So the question is that a legitimate plan? But you don't really hear a great deal of discussion in the media about whether it is or not.
And as far as the president running on a record that he has established over the past 4 years, what can he be proud of from that record, and what should he be ashamed of?
Well, there's definitely not much that he's accomplished on the economic front. You can only take a kind of what-if scenario and say, well, at least we've had growth. It's not, you know, good growth, but it is not our economy's sort of having negative growth the way it has happened in Europe, where the politicians did nothing in terms of stimulus. And although the stimulus bill may have been flawed in many people's minds, the Congressional Budget Office, which is most people would consider pretty nonpartisan, said, yes, it added a significant number of jobs. And he can say, which sounds like a very tepid endorsement of one's own policies, if I hadn't done this, it would be worse. But that's, a kind of tricky thing to run on, and that's kind of why both candidates perhaps would rather talk about the other candidate and how they're in league with the devil than their own records.
So for someone like you, who has aligned themselves in the past with the Republican Party, does not seem to be overly pleased with the candidate, is looking at the Democratic side that you have grave misgivings about, what do you do?
What I do is what I suggest more Americans would do, which is detach yourself from a sort of polarized tribal loyalty to one party or the other and think independently. Because when you're thinking as an ideologue, you're not thinking. You're just giving sort of rote slogans that other people like Karl Rove or David Axelrod are putting in your head. Analyze it. Hold the media to account to talk about fiscal issues, which may be boring to some people, but they're extremely important. It's what the politicians in Washington are doing with our money.
With that said, can you see yourself, under circumstances, voting for Barack Obama?
I could see myself under circumstances. I'm not real thrilled with the prospect. I think that's why we need a revamping of our electoral system. We need to get the politics out of money so both parties aren't so dominated by corporate concerns from their contributors. We need to reform this whole process whereby state legislatures can gerrymander congressional districts so you only get safe Democrat or safe Republican seats. That's, you know, ultimately the way out.
And the way out, also, we're looking at a way out of the economy that we're in.
Definitely we are. We need a credible plan for deficit reduction over the long term. And most people, most economists, I'd say even most people on Wall Street, would say it ain't going to happen unless we have some combination of spending cuts and revenue increases.
You say in the book, as in so many things, the first step is to follow the money. It seems that we've been given ample opportunity to do that. Why do we not?
It's becoming even more difficult now since the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010. Now we're getting these phony 501c4, quote-unquote, social welfare organizations that are just fronts for campaigns, and they funnel anonymous money into the campaigns.
So let us end on a note of, where does your optimism lie?
My optimism lies in the fact that we're not a country like Greece that's, you know, a small country dependent on tourism and not even controlling its own currency. We have a lot of human capital. We have a lot of natural resources. A lot of the economic problems and fiscal problems we have, we created them through our broken political system. If we can fix that, we can fix the other problems.
Mike Lofgren is the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. It's published by Viking. Mike Lofgren, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.